I think a lot of people are really stuck where they don't want to be, and they don't have the mental fortitude or the faith in themselves to say, okay, I'm going to take the first step, and then I'll figure out the second, third, fourth, fifth steps after that. They just can't take that first step. So that's why I say that everything is mental. If you can't get over the mental block, then nothing else matters. It doesn't matter how much money you have, how much freedom you have. If you don't believe that you are wealthy, if you don't believe that you are free, then you never would be.
Welcome to Life with Bitcoin, where we delve into the human side of Bitcoin by focusing on Bitcoiners' personal transformations and life stories. I'm your host, Vivian. Thanks for tuning in. If you like and want to support our mission on shining light on the human side of Bitcoin, remember to subscribe to this channel, leave a comment, or send a few sats from the link in the description. Today, our guest is Evan Rally, aka Captain Sid. Evan is the founder of The Rite of Passage, a travel company using adventure and camaraderie to drive personal growth, an American living in Thailand. He's building a life of freedom through Bitcoin and travel while helping others gain that same sovereignty. Welcome, Evan.
Thanks for having me, Vivian. Happy to be here.
I had Texas Slim on my show many months ago. It was one of the earlier episodes, and we were talking about how he went through an experience. And I later found out that was through your experience at Rite of Passage. So it feels like karma has come full circle to have you join us in a conversation. So thanks for taking the time.
No way. Yeah, Slim was a huge part of the whole reason I started Rite of Passage, really.
I'm sure we'll be digging into that. And we also met in person in Prague, during BTC Prague. And thank you very much for the favorite souvenir.
So this is basically just a pot of herbs, of dried herbs, and it lasts for years, really. This one's probably 6 months old now, but I've had these for years, and they're stuck in every drawer in my whole house. And they're good for everything, really. They're basically the same herbs that you have in like Vicks vapor rubs. So they kind of open up the sinuses. But I'll sniff this to stay awake. I'll sniff it to relax and chill out. I just leave them everywhere. And they're really good for car sickness. People like them for motion sickness. So they make a great little gift. Because even people that come to Thailand, foreigners that come to Thailand, they don't know about this. And they wouldn't even think to buy it because they just never heard of it. But among Thais, they're super popular. So it's a great thing to travel with and just hand out as little gifts to people I meet.
I can tell, and I can see why. And I've been using this religiously. Thank you for the great little souvenir from Thailand that I got from Prague. Let's dive into some of your stories. You call yourself Captain Sid. Why Captain Sid? Do you have any backstory or special meaning of this nickname?
Kind of an accident, really. So that name comes from the fact that my dad is an airline pilot. He's a captain. He's been a captain for many years, first of the 777 and now the 787. So I picked captain because of that. Travel has always been a big part of my life. I grew up flying a lot and traveling to foreign countries because we would fly standby on that airline. So captain came from that, and Sid came from Siddhartha, from the book Siddhartha. That was a book that I read probably the first time when I was maybe 18 or 19, like right when I started college. And I really liked the story and the sort of, every time I read it, I feel like I get a different perspective on my life through that story. Every time it's different. It's not the same story because it's kind of a general, generic story. I think it's supposed to be like the story of the Buddha, but written by Hermann Hesse, who I think is German in, I don't know, 1800 or something. It's kind of a general story, and it's only like 100 pages. I can read it in a few days, and I don't read fast at all. And every time I read it, I kind of pick up on new things, or it resonates with what I'm going through at that time in a different way. So I really like that book. And basically, Captain Sid came about because I wanted to change my Twitter username, because it used to be my real name, and I wanted to change it as I got into Bitcoin. At the time, I was working for a crypto exchange, and they were super hardcore about security and told us, like, never, ever, ever talk about this in public. Say you work for a light bulb company so people think it's boring and won't ask you more questions. Like, it was like working at the CIA. They were really intense about security. So they kind of drilled it into me. Okay, if I'm going to get involved with this and talk about it online, I should divorce it from my face, my, you know, name, whatever. So I put Captain Sit Up as my new handle and had that since probably 2019 or 2020 as I started getting into Bitcoin Twitter. And then in 2022, I did this motorcycle trip across the US where I went to like 30 different Bitcoin meetups on a Harley. And that's where the name became more than a handle, because I remember going to Bitcoin 2022 in Miami. That was where I started the trip because I figured there's going to be a lot of Bitcoiners there. I can get a lot of attention. I didn't know anyone at that point really in person. I'd been in Thailand just on Twitter a little bit. I had maybe 500 followers at that time, but I got Swan and Unchained Capital and a couple other companies to sponsor the trip. So I knew I have to deliver on this. I have to do some interviews with people and really make this trip into something. So when I was at the conference walking around, I carried the saddlebag from my bike, one of these huge plastic bags that slaps onto the side that you store stuff in. And I painted both saddlebags orange. So people knew, because I had tweeted out a picture of like, this is me, Captain Sid, with the saddlebag. Well, I didn't say I was Captain Sid. I just posted a picture of myself with the saddlebag. Then people came up to me and they're like, oh, you're Sid. Hey, you're doing that trip across the US. And I was like, yeah. And the first couple of people I corrected, and I said, my name is Evan, but yeah, that's my handle. And then I realized, you know what, I'm going to be meeting thousands of people. People are going to be coming up to me at meetups. I'm just going to go with Sid. If that's seemed to be what people were addressing me as naturally. So, and then I found out on the trip that a lot of people thought my real name was Sid and that I just threw Captain in front of it for whatever reason. So it's kind of how Captain Sid, it was total accident how it came about, but it sort of stuck. So I kind of use it now. But after that trip, now I introduce myself as Evan, but then people see me online and they're like, why are people calling you Sid? So I've had to clarify it a little bit and sort of run with both.
Did you find picking your own name empowering? Because I pick my own name and I somehow find it a very empowering thing that you're projecting meanings on a name that you pick that you think will represent yourself or meaningful to you.
I don't really feel like I picked it because, like I said, it was just my Twitter handle and then people started calling me that. But that said, I did find that on the trip, it helped me sort of do things that Evan wouldn't. So for instance, I'm a pretty shy person, actually. Like, I'm not the super outgoing type that would do something like go to 30 different Bitcoin meetups and shake 1,000 hands. And that's kind of why I did the trip. That was part of the reason, is I wanted to challenge myself and meet a lot of people and put myself out there. And so having the name Sid and people calling me Sid, it allowed me to reinvent myself and say, well, Sid would do that. Sid is the guy that would go to all these Bitcoin meetups and shake all these hands, and not have to tie that with my history and my older identity. So in a way, it has helped me sort of reinvent myself in certain ways. And that's been positive.
On your Twitter bio, you say, believe in yourself, everything is mental. And I think that's serves as a perfect example of the moment you shift your perspective and you adapt a new framework in approaching new things, taking risks, and everything becomes different with the different lens. So I'm a firm believer of this as well. Like, believe in yourself, everything's mental. But I want to hear your perspective on, why do you think everything is mental and how everything can be mental?
And we spend most of our lives dealing with was created by people. I have this vision for what I want Rite of Passage to do for people. And if I don't believe in that, that's the first, like that will guarantee failure in the way that nothing else can. And so I don't necessarily know that just having that faith alone is going to create something huge, but you definitely need that belief. That's like the absolute prerequisite. And I remember, like, especially when I moved to Thailand, a lot of my friends would reach out to me and say, oh, I could never do something like that. I could never leave and go to Thailand. And it just struck me as so odd, because all I did was get a plane ticket. I just got on a plane and got here. And then you figure out, okay, where am I going to stay? What am I going to do tomorrow? Where am I going to eat? And you figure everything out one step at a time. But if you don't have the faith that you can figure it out, then you never will. You'll never take the step, and you'll be stuck wherever you are now. And if you like that, then that's fine. But I think a lot of people are really stuck where they don't want to be, and they don't have the mental fortitude or the faith in themselves to say, okay, I'm going to take the first step, and then I'll figure out the second, third, fourth, fifth steps after that. They just can't take that first step. So that's why I say that everything is mental. If you can't get over the mental block, then nothing else matters. It doesn't matter how much money you have, how much freedom you have. If you don't believe that you are wealthy, if you don't believe that you are free, then you never will be. You know, you create a cage that you'll stay in for the rest of your life.
Was this something that you've always believed, or there was a journey for you to land on this belief?
I don't think it was something that I always believed. I wasn't really like this, like when I was younger. I think it's more the experiences that I went through, especially going to college. I left everything that I had known in the Midwest, and I moved to the East Coast. So that was sort of a moment where I had to reinvent myself. And like I said, back then I was extremely shy. So I had to get over that and make new friends and put myself out there and, you know, create an entirely new life. And I think through that experience, through coming to Thailand, through building this business, definitely, I've realized how important that faith is, especially with building this business. Because I noticed that, like, every day I'm facing new challenges. And when I don't believe that I can pull them off, things get worse and worse and spiral. But if I have that foundation of, I will figure this out, suddenly opportunities start popping up. And it may not happen in the way that I planned, but naturally opportunities start arising, and I'm in the right position and the right mindset to seize them and move forward. And life just gets instantly so much better. I feel like building a business, the ups and downs are much, much larger than they were working in a job. Working in a job, you're so insulated, and you know, you just, yeah, your boss yells at you one day or isn't happy with something. Okay, like, you feel a little bit worse, and then you complete a project, you feel a little bit better, but you're in this little zone. With building a business, it's like one day I'm way down here and the next day I'm way up here. And I've had to learn how to sort of modulate that and stay level. And having that faith and belief in myself is a huge part of that. Absolutely huge part of it. It's so much more important than it ever was when I was working.
I agree. And the magnitude of running your own business, the stakes are so much higher, like your own livelihood, your own, I guess, sense of meaning that's attached to that role you're playing, your business. It's so huge. That definitely create a different experience and landscape to look through work in general and life and purpose and meaning and all these important things that we all think about as humans. A couple of days ago, I was rewatching Matrix, and one particular scene that really stuck with me, and I think it's linked to this mentality of everything's mental. So in the scene that Morpheus took Neo to see Oracle in the Matrix, and the Oracle was telling Neo that you're not the one. You're not the one who saves the world, but Morpheus believes in you, but you're not. You're not him. And then right after that, she said, but you're not someone who believe in fate. You're someone who believe that you create your own reality, and you don't want the fate tells you where your life path is going to go. And then he went out and started to create all these actions and eventually become the one. And it's hard to say who gets there first, right? Is the Oracle already seen this? That's why she said it? Or is Neo being who he is and doesn't believe in fate and have that sheer faith in himself through the circumstances he's been with? And that left me thinking, like, the mental part, the faith part, really starts from the faith. It really starts from the mental note that I want to do this, I can do this, it should be me who's doing this. So that it changes your behavior and creates that feedback, positive feedback loop that lead you to the right direction, right? But sometimes it's hard to keep that positive mindset and feedback loop going. So the next question I have is, how do you maintain a strong and positive mindset, especially in challenging times? And if
really good question.
If it all starts mental, how can we put ourselves in that mental space when we just don't feel like it?
Yeah, this is something that I've struggled and still struggle with, but struggled with for a very long time. It's like, how do you change that mood? And there's a lot of things that I've tried. Like in college, I went really down the Eastern philosophy rabbit hole, like meditation and Buddhism and all that. And that I still use a lot of those mindsets and practices, like meditation, for example. I just got the Headspace app again. I used to use it in college. And then I had been meditating for years just on my own and realized that all I was doing was sitting for 10 minutes. Especially when I was working, it wasn't so bad. Then I really felt like, oh, I'm meditating and I'm getting something out of this. But when I started doing my own business, there's so many thoughts flying around. I'm like, okay, I need some guidance, some more, you know, help doing this. And that's why I got the Headspace app again, because it provides you some more guardrails and guidance and things to think about to distract you from, you know, what is going on. And so that sort of thinking of the monkey mind and being able to dissociate from the thoughts, not necessarily dissociate, but allow the thoughts to run without attaching to them, and just letting the negative and positive thoughts flow without judging or attaching. That mindset has helped me a ton. Another big practice that I've tried to do, but probably not done that well, but when I do it is good, is, I forget where I got this from, but like when times are good, that's when you work really, really, really hard because you have all the energy. But when times are bad, you have to know when enough is enough and you need to stop and relax and reset. And that's something I used to be really bad at. I would get obsessed with a problem and I couldn't get up until it was solved. And it would just get worse and worse because my ability to solve that problem would get worse as my mood went down. And now I'm much better and much more practiced at stepping away and calming down or doing something else, or weirdly enough, like rewarding myself, doing something that gives me pleasure, going for a walk, just taking a time out, because that extra 30 minutes that I take to take a time out is going to get me back hours and hours and hours of frustration that I would have spent trying to solve that problem. So that's big thing that I've tried to implement as well that's helped me. Just take a break. Like, I think there's so much of, and I'm involved in a lot of this, like the entrepreneurship hustle culture that's like work your 9-to-5 job and then come home and work another 8 hours and sleep 2 hours and go back to your 9-to-5. I don't understand those people. Like, I'm sure there are people like that out there, but that is not me. And I'm never going to be successful doing that because I will just burn out. And I could spend that much time in front of a computer, sure, but nothing will get done and I'll just destroy my life and my mood and everything. So is that really worth it? Probably not. And I think that's part of like the fiat thing, right? You have to do that. If you're starting a company in America, like you have to do that because you can't afford to, you know, in most places, if you're living and earning in that country, you can't afford to not earn. You know, you have to save for so long. It just, it's not feasible. So big plus to moving to Thailand as well around that subject.
And even if you save for so long and you finally seem to have a runway, then because you've went through so much pain to save, that every single day that goes by that you don't have an income working on whatever you want, like it's put so much pressure on individuals. And I'm sure you're not the only one. And I definitely can relate on the inability of taking a break, the inability of thinking it's okay to not do things for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. Why do you think postmodern individuals have this tendency to feel like they always need to be doing something? Like, where is that urge coming from?
I used to call it the rat race, the hamster wheel, the matrix. And I mean, you wanted to avoid the topic, but I think it is because of the money. I think it's because we have to run faster and faster to stay in the same place. And whether Bitcoin is the solution or not, like, I think it's sort of a sideshow to the fact that there's a big problem, and that over time it's becoming more and more expensive to live the same lifestyle. And so you have to keep chasing. And I think that's created, because it's happened so slowly, has created a culture. Instead of being a crisis, where now it's starting to feel like a crisis because inflation is running so hot and it's become a household topic. But I think over the last, call it 100 years, it has become this culture of we have to work harder and harder and harder. And it's like boiling the frog. It's happened so slowly that we don't realize really that it's a problem until you look back that far and you realize, like, oh, people were not hustling like this 100 years ago in quite the same way to stay at the same place. But we're just on this hamster wheel, and we have to run faster and faster and faster to afford a house, to provide for our families, to do these basic things that we thought were just part of, you know, growing up and getting a job, and then it would all get taken care of. And so it's harder to, ironically, then it's harder to have the faith that things will get figured out because you don't see the proof anywhere. So then people lose the faith, and then all they have is just grinding. And that's a big part of why I feel like I've been more able to take those breaks, is when I don't have faith in what I'm doing, I can't take a break, because all that matters is the work in front of me. But when I have faith that it will work out, then I can step away for an hour because I'm not so freaked out that I have to get this done right now. Because I know, okay, I'm going to go relax, and this will in due time get figured out. Might not get figured out today or this week or this month, but it will get figured out. And that is so important to being able to just, like, relax, take the stress off, and then return to the problem.
Interesting. That's a good rule of thumb. I'm going to take note of this. So next time I feel restless, basically, it basically means I'm not on the right path. I think that's a pretty good indicator of we need this little, like, trick and tips to help us connect with our mind and body together, to realize if we're walking on on the right path. And this is something that I feel like would be beneficial. And let's talk about comfort zone. Before you moved to Thailand, you were living in New York. Thailand and New York, those are two very different places. And you shared on other shows that you felt the urge of leaving New York without knowing what it was. And let's dig deeper on that. Like, looking back, can you piece together what was missing?
At that time, I was working a remote job, working for a crypto exchange from my tiny apartment in New York, living with my girlfriend at the time. And it was a weird place because I had just gotten that job. And suddenly I went from most of 2018, I had no job. I quit in January of 2018. I was working for a marketing tech company, and I went and did a bunch of freelance stuff and worked in crypto and went to all these conferences and meetups and things. And it was exciting, but living in New York City, burning cash like crazy, and basically ran out of savings within like 6 months. And then I started doing more serious contract work. I worked for Envision for a little while. That was like a weird trial of a job. So it was almost full-time pay and almost full-time hours, but I wasn't like fully hired yet. And that lasted for about like 3 months. Then I got that job at the crypto exchange, and suddenly I was making more money than I had made before. I was comfortable, but within like 2 weeks of starting that job, the itch came back of like, this is just not right. Like, I don't really want to be here doing this. Something is not right about my lifestyle. And I think a lot of that was New York. A lot of that was American, like, pre-professional culture. The bubble I was in New York was consultants and investment bankers mostly. And everything about the conversation and their lives was complaining about work and how stressed they were about their job. And then when they weren't doing that, they were getting drunk or going out to eat. And that was like the only things anyone ever did. And I went hiking a few times and that was super fun and very different. But going hiking in New York was, first of all, you can only really do it in the summer. And then you got to go to the train station, take a $30 train up for like an hour, hour and a half, get off, hike for 2 hours, come back, take the train back. It's an all day thing. It's expensive. Like, this is, why would I live here if this is what I enjoy? And so it started grating at me that I didn't want to be in New York. I also was very tired of that relationship and didn't know how to get out of it. So I thought, hey, what if I move abroad and just totally change my lifestyle? Kind of felt like I need to throw a wrench into this, but I'm not sure what's wrong. So I'll try a major drastic change and then see what I like and don't like. And I kind of had this fantasy of moving abroad.
To change your life around, it only takes one radical decision. But it has to be radical enough to turn your life upside down and then to undo all of the ties from the past and then to regrow, like plant new seeds and tend new plants to basically see what happens. Like nobody ever told you it will be for the better, but you just have to go for it. And then you shared before you moved to Thailand, you were thinking about the three choices you had. And the second one, besides Thailand, it was Mexico City and Amsterdam. So why these three places? And when you pick places to make these radical changes, what factors do you consider?
The first thing I'll say about like making the radical change was when I was kind of making a final decision on this. So I had the initial impulse like December of 2018. And then in 2019, for about 2 months, I was thinking about it and going back and forth. And that was extremely stressful. Like, I actually started seeing a therapist during that time because I didn't know what was going on. Like, I just felt like a total wreck. And then I basically decided that instead of saying, I'm going to move to this place, I said, I'm going to try 90 days there and see if I like it. And that's how I came up with that plan of three cities, 90 days. Like, if I like one, then I'll just stay there or I'll keep moving. And that sort of boxed it so that I could make a radical change. But I knew like my friends aren't going to delete me on Facebook if I go to Thailand for 90 days. Like, I can come back. I can come back to New York. And if I really hate it, I can just come back and I still had the job too. So I had that security. I could come back and continue my normal life and just have this adventure for 90 days. So that made it way more palatable and easy to chew. As far as those three cities, they were all places that I had traveled to previously that, for lack of a better way to describe it, I just had a good feeling about them. So like I said, I traveled a lot as a kid. I was very fortunate to travel internationally a bunch. And those three places to me felt very livable in a way that maybe it was just the things that I did in a lot of other cities, but they felt less touristy and more comfortable, especially Chiang Mai and Thailand. Something about the culture and the people, it just felt immediately when I got here, it felt so warm and welcoming and just a nice place to live. Not necessarily to travel for like a week. Like, people come to Chiang Mai and ask me, what should I do for a week-long vacation? I don't know. Like, you can go see the elephants, you can go look at some temples, but it's not a super exciting place to be. There isn't that much to see, but it's an incredible place to just relax and spend some time. And I got that feeling in all three of those cities. Like, Mexico City, I had gone to maybe three or four trips before I moved to Thailand. When I was living in New York, it was sort of like the hip place to go among my friend groups, go to Mexico City. So I went a couple times. The food's great. The people are great. It's very walkable in certain parts of the city. Like, I just thought it was really nice. And Amsterdam, I had been during college with my parents. And what really struck me about Amsterdam, at least back then, was the streets were very quiet. There were very little lights and advertisements. Like, the storefronts were very muted. There wasn't any like ads hanging and big banners and stuff. It just felt very homey and relaxing, but not dead. Like there's people walking around, there's coffee shops, there's restaurants that are bustling, there's activity, but it's not like New York where, you know, you take the wrong step into the street and people are screaming at you, and it's just a very tense environment. It didn't have that feeling at all. So that's kind of how I came to those three.
Did you experience any pushback when you made the move?
I remember with my parents, that was one that I thought about a lot and focused on a lot. And they were very confused. Like, why do you want to do this? Why would you move across the world? And they didn't really get it until they came and visited. And they each came and visited separately. My mom came in the end of 2021 and my dad at the end of 2022. And after those trips, they realized two things. One, that I'm not coming back. And two, that there's a good reason that I'm there. Like my dad said to me when he visited that you seem so much more calm and like present than you ever did in the US. You just feel, you know, more well adjusted here. So I think they now understand why I'm here. But back when I made the decision, they really didn't. I don't think it was a big thing for their generation. And, you know, it's starting to be a big thing for my generation, for our generation. But for them, they're like, why don't you just get a job and work for 40 years and retire? It just, I think, seemed a little strange at that time. And it was very sudden. Like I was living in New York. I had a good job. Like, why would you want to leave? You know? So it was more confusion than pushback, really.
Oftentimes we have to leave that to time and circumstances, and people really oftentimes we need to see for ourselves when we are in disbelief of something. And that's the same with Bitcoin oftentimes. Like they don't see, if they don't see the pain point, if they don't feel the pressure from the fiat system on their own shoulder, it's very hard to conceptualize what it means to other people or what it could mean for themselves. Oftentimes we have to drag people through the same cycle that we've been through, even though we know that it's not going to be easy to go through, but we have to bring them onto that journey so they gain a solid understanding of what things are like. And now you're quite integrated into local culture. It's been quite a few years, and then you speak Thai now. And is there a Thai word that you like? Because every language I know have these words that have specific meanings that you don't quite have a direct translation for in other languages.
I guess two. One is Guan Tin and one is Man Kiao. And they're kind of related. Guan Tin means something like annoying, but in a playful sense. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's okay. Like somebody who is, they joke around a lot and they can be kind of irritating, but it's funny and it's playful and it's meant, you know, they mean well, but they just, sometimes it's irritating. And I've been described as Guan Tin many times, like the way that I interact with people is very Guan Tin. You know, I make jokes and whatnot. And that's a very like Thai thing. And then Man Kiao is like something my girlfriend says to me all the time. And I don't know if I really have a good understanding of it, but she will like pinch me when she says Man Kiao. And it's something like a response to being Guan Tin. Like, I want to hurt you, but not really. Like, I want to poke you. I want to like twist you for saying that or doing that thing, but it's out of love, not out of wanting to annoy you or not liking you or whatever. It's like a, like, I want to squeeze you, like squeeze you really hard because I love you so much kind of thing.
That's cute. I literally never get disappointed when I ask people this question who speak a language I don't know, because they always have something that's like weirdly specific. You can tell a lot about the culture and what people care about in that culture and what people seem to gravitate towards. What has been one of the most rewarding aspects of this integration into local culture? Like, are there any cultural practices or philosophies that have particularly resonated with you and kind of gave you this whole new perspective because you're there?
Yeah, I only learned about this like maybe earlier this year, this concept of not wanting to impose on others, that is called Greng Jai. Jai means heart. I'm not really sure what Greng translates to, but the concept is called Greng Jai. And it's this idea that you don't want to impose your will on someone else. And it plays out in all sorts of really like strange ways here that to a Westerner probably seem really odd. Like, I remember the story of a group of foreigners that came into a restaurant and they had like one no smoking sign on the wall and they just started smoking in the restaurant and nobody did anything about it. Like the waitress is serving them, whatever, just like everyone else. No one did anything about it. And then the next day there were no smoking signs everywhere. And that's sort of like a metaphor for how I see a lot of how Thais deal with conflict. Like they don't want to impose on you. They may not like what you're doing, but they're not really going to show you that. It'll come out in like a sign or some sort of official channel so that they don't have to like approach you directly about it. And I realize that I'm very much like that. Like I've always been I avoid conflict. I want to get along with everyone. I don't want to impose on somebody. And I like living in a society like that. And I've come to realize a lot of people don't like living in a society like that. They want to confront people. And I understand that now. I didn't really understand it until I started thinking about this concept and how these different societies work. I understand that concept now, but that's something that I've really come to enjoy about being here and about the local culture, that people are deferential to each other. And there's a lot of talk, especially in the West, about how Eastern cultures are so conformist. And like you have CCP and communism and everyone has to fit into this box and all be the same. And that's true. And it's not. Like here, I found that in public, like people will act similarly. That Gringjai concept applies like in the mask scenario. If everyone's wearing masks, everyone else will put it on. Like they don't really want to impose on someone else. But it also means that you're pretty free. Like if you really need to do something that is kind of against the rules, people may judge you for it, but they're not necessarily going to do anything about it. You don't have Karens here that are going to chase you down and yell at you for doing something. And it just makes for me a very relaxing environment to be in.
I avoid conflicts too. And what you're talking about is basically I've seen from your example, I've seen a sign of respecting individual sovereignty, respecting individuals' freedom. Cause it's, if I'm the one who's smoking outside with that one smoking sign, and then the next day they're full of smoking signs, then it's them trying to create internal motivation within me to stop smoking on my own terms, mm-hmm. instead of ABC come to tell me you can't smoke here and be that justice warrior of trying to push your agenda onto other people. This definitely sounds like something I would enjoy. Like because when we think about how one becomes calm in society or relationships, it comes down to letting other people be themselves and letting ourselves be ourselves. And it's simple, but it's so difficult to do, especially if you're in a group where you know these people, where you're trying to get something done, or in a relationship where you're trying to push your partner in a certain directions that benefit the both of you. But you have to remember that if they're going to change, they have to be changing on their own terms. They have to want it too, instead of telling me you should be doing this, you should be doing that. And people usually get more rebellious for that. And then, well, that's one. And then the other thing is that if people get told what to do and then they just do it all of the time, then over time, they're going to lose their ability to know how to think for themselves. And this is what we see in society all day, every day, with the deep state and have like massive mandates and imposing these rules onto each individual. And that's hugely impacting our ability to think for ourselves and act, like have that responsibility of our own actions as well.
I find that like the foreigners that come here, the really type A ones that need things to be a certain way. They just don't last. They hate it because they can't handle, like, yeah, mechanics aren't, you know, always super detailed about things. The plumber comes over, sometimes you have to watch and like make sure they're doing it the right way or whatever, because sometimes they're just the quality or attention to detail is lower than what they might expect. But you get so much in exchange for that, that to me, it's very much worth it.
Would you say in Thailand, because of culturally, this is how they approach individual conduct and operate in the society, would you say on average, people in Thailand are more sovereign?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know so much that it has to do with the culture entirely, but also with just the way that the society organizes. Like, people are much more locally oriented here. And I don't know if that's just like a place in a cycle or something that Thailand is in versus the West. But in America, like, everyone is so concerned about who the president is, but they have no idea who their city council leader is or who their state senators are or any of that, because none of that to the American mind like matters. You know, people don't put any emphasis on that. They put all the emphasis on whoever's in DC making these big overarching rules. Whereas here, there's a lot more emphasis on the local, and you see like very active, small groups that are getting things done. And especially when you get outside of the cities, like, small towns are very sovereign. Like, small villages here, they have everything that they need, and it's changing. Like, according to people that I know who have been here for a while or who have families here that, you know, that are Thai that have been here for multiple generations, it's becoming more dependent on centralized systems, especially through finance and banking. And you see a lot of like new trucks and new motorbikes and stuff driving around, and they're all bank loans. And so you see that kind of infecting into the countryside, which has pros and cons, right? People are upgrading their lifestyles, they're getting new things, or they're getting better trucks so they can do more war work in the fields and they can make more money and everything. But you also see some of that communal living starting to dwindle as people are more reliant on bigger centralized systems. But I think right now, for sure, the average Thai person is way more sovereign than like the average Westerner.
There's a misconception thinking that the biggest boss are going to make the most impactful decisions for each individual, like ourselves. So that's an interesting observation. You've obviously find a lifestyle and community in Thailand that works well for you. And do you think you would have the same sense of belonging or fulfillment if you were born and raised there? And how does being an outsider with a different perspective and reach or reduce your experience?
I think it does play a big role that I came here as an outsider. Like, a lot of these cultural concepts, the idea of Grangjai and like conforming, like, I get to reap the benefits of that, but I don't necessarily feel the social pressure that a lot of Thai people feel. They feel it on a much deeper level. And I've seen this with my girlfriend at different interactions. Like, she will feel uncomfortable doing or saying things that I wouldn't have a second thought about. And it's because of how she was raised and the culture she was raised in. So for me to come here, it's easier for me to do those things, to get a little bit more confrontational and address a situation. Whereas for her, it's very difficult because of the way that she was raised.
I'm sure this is part of the charm of the rite of passage experience that you bring to people and have people come all over the world to Thailand and to experience something that they would never have even imagined in a way. And so let's talk about the program. But before we talk about program, let's talk about being a biker, motorcyclist. I can draw a little bit of a similarity between the biker community and Bitcoin community. The first thing is that they're a little bit mysterious. Both of groups are a little bit mysterious. Mm-hmm. They hang out with their packs, and then they dress a specific way. Like, they have these motorcycle jackets and they have helmets. And it's like Bitcoiners have laser eyes and wear orange items on them. And then they have a little bit of, Anon feature like the anonymous feature in a way, because on the road, like the bikers always have their helmet on. You can't really see them. Yeah, I definitely sense a little bit of a mysterious vibe from the bike community. And it feels a little exclusive too, because they seem to look a certain way and they make these noises on the road, especially for these louder ones. And for people who are not in the community, they can seem a little bit intimidating, just like Bitcoiners. So picking a brain on this, what are some of the common misconceptions of the biker community that you could identify that could help the average everyday person who are not a biker understand this community a bit more?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'll say is like that, and I didn't realize this until I started riding. When I grew up, I thought that all motorcyclists were like the Harley Davidson with the vest, like Hell's Angels type. I thought that was riding a motorcycle. Like you're sitting back on this big hog. And I was never interested in motorcycles. I was never interested in that lifestyle and that, you know, kind of way of living. And so I always thought motorcycles were stupid, to be honest. Before I moved to Thailand, I thought, you're just an organ donor. Like you're just going to kill yourself on the road. Why would you want to do that? And then coming here, had to get on two wheels. So I got on a scooter, and I had used bicycles a lot living in New York as well. So I loved like riding through traffic and the adrenaline of that. And I did that in college as well. So I probably had 7 years of riding in traffic experience. And then I got on a scooter and I'm like, wow, this is like a bicycle, except way faster, way more adrenaline. And then I just got bigger and bigger bikes and started to get more and more into it. But I've since realized that there are so many subgroups, just like Bitcoin. Like you have the laser eyed maxis, but there's so many other subgroups within Bitcoin that they all share that common thing, but they're very different in their approaches and in how they dress and how they act. So on one hand, you have the biker gang guys that they don't want to wear helmets. They wear a t-shirt with a leather vest. I'm obviously stereotyping, but that's like the biker gang stereotype. But then you have the sport riders as well that are in $2,000 leather tracksuits with airbags in them and helmets. And they're like laser focused on how do I shave half a second off my lap time. But they share that love of the freedom of two wheels, the thrill of two wheels. Then you have the off-road riders, the adventure riders, all these different groups of riders, but they all have that same love and appreciation for what the motorcycle provides. And a big reason that I combined like motorcycles and Bitcoin with this is because to me, there's a very big overlap in what both teach you. Both Bitcoin and motorcycles, they provide a ton of freedom to the user, right? You can go anywhere with your Bitcoin, you can use it anywhere, but they also provide a lot of, or they call for a lot of responsibility. If you don't know how to handle your Bitcoin, how to make a transaction, how to avoid a scam website that's going to give you two Bitcoin back for one Bitcoin or whatever, then you're very quickly going to get ripped off and lose that, or you're going to mishandle it and lose all your coins. And the motorcycle is the same thing. If you don't know how to ride the bike, it's very unforgiving. You don't have a metal box around you with a bunch of airbags. You are in the environment. So when you slide at 70 miles an hour, like you pay the price for that crash. And I think that's a big part of what unites motorcyclists, that you're taking such a huge risk, but hopefully at the end of every ride, you take your helmet off and you step inside and you're okay. But you get that thrill. You really put yourself out there and you had to trust yourself and the machine to carry you through. That's what I love about it so much.
You have to stay super sovereign all of the time to just be alive. And the responsibility is huge. And not even mention like with motorcycle, because you can be fast. And of course, like part of the reason you do it is for the thrill, is for the adrenaline. And there's always this active risk management going on in your brain. And you mentioned there are different type of bikers, just like there are different type of Bitcoiners. And now with your experience meeting with so many Bitcoiners, either in Thailand or out in these Bitcoin conferences in different parts of the world or meetups, if you could describe the collective of Bitcoiners in three words, what would those be? Like, what are some of the common qualities do you think unite people within Bitcoin community?
So I feel like I got a good flavor for this riding across the US, and it was not something that I expected to really gain an understanding of or to notice. But I noticed that Bitcoiners are very diverse. You have people from all over the place doing all different things, all different mindsets, all different stories. And they are united more by their sort of personality and approach to life, and obviously Bitcoin, than anything else. But that allows them to get along super well. Another reason why I picked Bitcoiners for rite of passage too. I know that they'll get along. As long as they're real Bitcoiners, they will get along, because I saw so many diverse people get along. But as far as three words, I think honest would definitely be one, just a belief in the power of honesty, in speaking truth, in being yourself, being honest to yourself. Hardworking is definitely one. Like, I see just a very strong work ethic and a willingness to step in and help out, which kind of ties into the third one, which is responsible. That's probably the biggest one that I noticed, is Bitcoiners they take responsibility for the situation at hand. Like, a very good sort of petri dish for understanding Bitcoiners for me was, in the middle of my motorcycle trip across the US, I went to a very unique beefsteak event. So a lot of Bitcoiners will be familiar with the concept of a beefsteak. The account Away Slice, he's a chef and he hosts these beefsteak dinners. And then you probably know him from like the Miami conference and a lot of the big conferences, where he'll host a dinner for one night, basically, and you just eat like seven courses of beef. Well, he did a very unique trip in, I think it was in Minnesota, or maybe we were in northern Wisconsin. But anyway, people flew into Minneapolis and we rented cars and drove like 3 or 4 hours into the middle of nowhere, where we had barely any cell service. And we camped for like 3 days off grid. One huge thing I'll never forget is we had a fire going basically the entire weekend. I don't think it was ever put out. And there was a huge, like, someone brought a truck and dumped like a huge pile of firewood. And we had to move that like another 10 meters to the fire. And of course, we didn't move it all at once. Like, people would just come and bring it. But I noticed that I never saw anyone tell anyone else to bring firewood. And a Wayslice, who runs the whole thing, like, for the food, he was obviously the guy. Like, if we wanted to help, we would ask him and he would tell us what to do. But I didn't ever see him tell anyone, like, can you get more wood? If the wood was low and no one was around, he would just go get it. But a lot of times there'd be 5 or 6 people sitting around the fire and we're all talking, and someone would notice that the wood is low and they just get up and get more wood. There was never a, you need to do this. It's, what can I do to help? And people were just naturally noticing these things. And it was a magical weekend. We had so much fun because everyone is just helping each other out in the ways that we all needed it at that time for the whole group. And there was never any, like, I didn't see any conflict or like orders or anything. It was just totally self-organizing. It was so cool to be in that environment, and so much generosity. Like, people brought all this food and drinks and stuff, and everything was basically take whatever you want, you know? And then that comes with, you know, the Greng Jai expectation of like, don't take too much. Don't be that guy that like eats someone else's food and all of it. Yeah, you can try it. And you know, if they seem like, yeah, you can have some more, then go have some more. But it's such a cool environment to be in. And I felt like that started with personal responsibility. Everyone took responsibility for themselves and they're able to help everyone else out as well. And they felt responsible for the whole experience together.
Imagine in all life situations, instead of asking, you go do this, we ask, how can I do to help? world's going to be such a better place for if everyone has that mindset. Circling back to risk, and being in Bitcoin comes with certain risk. Being a biker comes with certain risk. And moving yourself across the world on a whim, that takes risk. And what do you think is a healthy relationship between an individual and risk? Because when we deal with risk, we have this natural level of fear that starts rising that is set to protect us as humans, because we need that adrenaline and that stimuli of fear to remind us in our surroundings to stay alive. But if we don't take risk, then your comfort zone actually shrinks. So what do you think is a healthy relationship between an individual and risk, and how can we do better risk management in general in all aspects in our lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you talked about fear a little bit, and it made me think about with motorcycling. At some point, as I was learning more and more about bikes and riding, I came across this concept of called the survival instinct or the survival response. And whatever resource I was reading, it kept hammering in again and again that you need to override your survival response. It's your fear that is going to kill you, not the situation or the bike. And a lot of times with a motorcycle, the bike is designed and engineered to stay upright and to stay on the road. And you'll notice this if you ride a good bike. If you ride a beat up bike, maybe it won't. But if you ride a good bike, you can take your hands off the handlebars and it will just cruise straight. On my Harley in the US, I rode like that for multiple minutes at a time on the highway in Kansas because it's so dead straight. I just sat back with the cruise control on and it rode, because it's designed to stay upright. And it is actually your instincts that are not built for that situation that are what's going to dislodge you from the bike. Great example is when you go too fast. I think it's like if you lift up the front wheel and you wheelie and you put it back down, if the wheels are off center, it will start to weave and the handlebars will literally jiggle back and forth. And I don't know how this happened. This was like God intervening or something, but I watched a video about it's called the speed weave. The day before, I rode like 5 hours without my phone to a meditation retreat, and I almost got hit. I almost, like, someone pulled right in front of me and I missed the back of their car by 2 feet. And at some point, because I was braking, I think I slammed the brakes and the clutch, which was stupid, and the rear brake. So I locked up the rear wheel and I slid out the rear wheel. Well, when I let all the brakes off again, everything came back and it started to weave. And my brain just clicked, like, don't touch the handlebars. And I lifted my hands up and the handlebars went back and forth for a good 2 seconds and then pinned straight and it was fine. Had I tried to grab the handlebars, I would have interrupted that process and gone down at 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
And I found that in a lot of parts of my life, like if I listen to the fear, that's when I start to screw up. And fear, to me, I'm trying to like retrain myself that it's a signal that you need to process, not react to, because your initial reaction to fear is usually not going to lead you in the right place, especially when you get fear raises your blood pressure, gets you into this fight or flight response, and then you end up doing something stupid or counterproductive. If you step back and observe what could that fear mean about what I'm supposed to do next or the situation that I'm in, and get a little bit more perspective and use it as a signal and not, I don't have the right metaphor for it, but you don't immediately respond to that fear, but actually process it first and figure out what it might mean in the larger picture, then you're more likely to deal with that risk properly. So I know I didn't talk about risk at all and your question was about risk, but yeah, that's kind of how I think about like the fears that come along with the risks that I've taken.
When you were going through this example, it just reminded me perhaps another commonality between bikers and Bitcoiners is that when dealing with motorcycles and when dealing with Bitcoin, you need to be a little bit counterintuitive. If you grab the bike, the handle when it was wiggling, then it's not going to end very well. And the same thing with Bitcoin. Now we're seeing this market crash, and it is in bad times that we stack sats. Like it is in the bad times that we have cheaper sats to stack. Let's talk about the rite of passage. First time I heard about the term rite of passage is in a screenwriting book. And it's this word that counts a ritual, an event, or experience that marks or constitutes a major milestone or change in a person's life. Now you've taken this program further with more experience and more people being involved. What do you think is the right persona for this program?
It's kind of a vague marker because there's so many ways to be at this position in your life. But when you're either right before or right after some sort of major event in your life. So I've had people sign up for this who are kind of where I was at in New York right before I moved to Thailand, where they kind of know they want to change something in their life, but they're not really sure what that is. They're looking for the next thing. And so like one guy that came last year, he just sold his business that he had been working on since he was 20 years old. And he's like in his 50s maybe now. So his whole adult life was spent building this business. He sold it and he's like, I want to figure out what I'm going to do next, but I'm not really sure where that's going to lead. And I think it's very good for that kind of person. It's very good for people who are right after a big event that similarly like changes everything, like a divorce or something that you feel like your whole life is changed through this experience and you want to get a new start. This is a great way to get that. Because what I've designed on the rite of passage, what I want to do for people is to really break how they see the world and change their perspectives on themselves, on their societies, on everything through travel. Get out of that comfort zone and really do things that are uncomfortable, but that's what changes you, is that discomfort. And that novelty where you're like, I don't really know what's going to happen through this situation. And now I see how people travel. And I used to travel like this too. And I still do sometimes travel like this, where you plan the entire trip before you even leave. And you know what you're going to see and what you're going to do. And you have all these preloaded expectations of everything. But those are the worst trips because all you get is pictures and you get some time to relax if you're overworked, and that alone is worth it. But Slim also gave me this, that a lot of people, the way they travel, they're literally changing the drapes on their living room. Like they will go to Cancun to a resort and stay in the resort and eat and drink all day and sit by the pool and relax. But they're like, oh, I went to Mexico. Yeah, but you didn't speak to a single Mexican. You didn't do anything really Mexican. You lived in a bubble made for other Americans like you to come stay and sit on the beach, which is fine. If you want to sit on the beach, you sit on the beach, but you're not really traveling. And so I wanted to create the rite of passage because I saw, especially with Thailand, so many people come here and never really experience like what I love about Thailand. They never get to see it because it's such a different culture that a lot of tour companies won't even show you parts of Thailand because they don't think you're interested in it, or they think it's going to be too weird and they're going to get negative reviews. But the way that I'm doing this, like I don't need to fill, you know, tours. I don't need to bottom feed and fill 20 tours every month. I can do one tour a year, two tours a year and have fun with it and just see it organically grow. And I know that Bitcoiners are interested in getting past that barrier of tourism versus traveling. They're interested in breaking their brains because Bitcoin probably already did that for them. It already changed how they see the world. So it kind of attracts those people who are addicted to it. And if they're not addicted to that kind of feeling of changing themselves, they see that after Bitcoin, it sprouts all these new interests and changes them in so many ways that they become more interested in doing this kind of thing and in really like changing their perspective. So that's kind of why I I pulled in Bitcoiners for it too.
It seems like you're in the market of people who have existential crisis. Before,
yeah, that's a good way to put
right?
it.
Yeah, it, like before and after big life changes, and this is when people start to question, really question who they are and what can I do in this world and what else can I do in this world if they've done something that they're proud of and they now need to move past that and they need to enter this new paradigm. Yeah, it seems like you're really in the business of fixing people's existential crisis, which is really noble work, to be honest, because a lot of people are in that. Our generation in general have this kind of existential crisis on the mass, just for the way we grew up, the influence we are under in the fiat society in general, and technology and social media, and how peer pressure is available to us 24/7, and we are voluntarily tuning into these peer pressure because they're so available, and it definitely offers a different perspective when you're thrown in a situation where you have absolutely no reference point of how to react and how to behave. And I can imagine how that's a really empowering and free kind of give you a deep sense of freedom to just be allowed to be out of whack, to be in a situation where you have absolutely no idea, to the point that you can be whoever you choose to be in that scenario. And that action, that experience will come back to feed you and give you new information on, oh, I didn't know I could be that. And if I could be that there, I could be that anywhere. Well, there's the potential, right? And it kind of changes how they think about the world. One of the things that pops for me in the highlight video of the Rite of Passage is how people comment on how unique and worthwhile the experience was. So what exactly are the things that people see, experience, feel, like in your design? Like what are the things that triggers them to have this magical transformation?
In short, like I take them to the things that did that for me. And I try to focus on, I'll just pull up the document. I have a document where I wrote some of these things down. Let me see if I can find it. but I wanted to have these like themes of, and I never shared this with anyone on the first trip, and I probably won't share it on the second trip either, because I think it's more powerful that you kind of experience it rather than being told like this is what you're supposed to experience, which is exactly the point why I don't show the itinerary. I don't want people to have preconceptions. I want them to just fall into the experience and get what they get out of it. But for me, at least last year, a lot of it was about sovereignty. Like I want people to feel an importance and a shift in their mind that one, sovereignty is important, and that sovereignty starts with your mind. Like we've been talking about, everything is mental. So I do things like Thai boxing, for example, where you're probably getting uncomfortable. You've never done that kind of thing before. A lot of people have never done a martial art, but to do that and to experience like hitting pads and hitting a bag and maybe sparring with other people, getting punched in the face, that's like an experience that rocks you, that changes you, and probably shows some of your weakness. A lot of people, especially Americans, and I'm guilty of this too, have like a lot of bravado, but cannot back it up, especially physically. And when you do a sport like Muay Thai and you get in the ring and even just sparring and you get punched in the face and you realize like, okay, wow, I'm not as capable as I thought I was. Like, I really don't know what I'm doing. And so like last year we did it with we did Muay Thai with my trainer, who he doesn't train really any foreigners. He mostly just trains like young kids in his village. So he brought two of his students, maybe one of his students. And that student, like watching her train, she's, I don't know, 16, 17 years old, but she could kick anyone in that group's ass. And they're all guys, you know, because she's so well-trained at combat. She can take a punch. She's fit. She's fast. She probably only weighs 40 kilos, but she's a really good fighter. And she's fighting in Bangkok actually this Saturday on Thai TV, on national TV. So learning kind of what your limits are physically and what it feels like to be humbled, I think, is a big part of it. I looked up before I did the trip, like, what is a rite of passage? Like, you need to be humbled. You need to have community and support around you. It's a lot about learning how to survive on your own, because traditionally a rite of passage is about growing up, right? So you're leaving the comforts of the family, of the home, of the tribe, and you have to figure out how to survive on your own. And that was a big part of what I wanted to imbue people with through this trip, is that they could see, you know, I can go through this trip and see things that I didn't know I was going to see, experience challenges, and riding in Thailand is its own challenge, its own risk, and come out the other side and say, okay, I could do that. And not only did I do it, but I had a blast doing it. I had a blast challenging myself and getting outside of my comfort zone, eating things I wouldn't eat, and, you know, doing things I wouldn't normally do. And I think that really spurs people, you know, beyond how they're thinking normally and creates a change that I want to create.
For sure. I can imagine it's going to be a very humbling experience when you thought you're strong and can throw a punch, but actually cannot. And then that would give you the perspective of maybe I shouldn't be as mean to some of the people. Because if I do end up in a fight in a real situation where they will throw a real punch and put me in a, you know, tricky situation, I have no chance. And it's good to have that understanding in the beginning of an argument. And I think people are going to, after, so this is a one-time experience, but it will end up serving as a lifetime lesson. And from a designing perspective, because when you're running a program like this, you're essentially designing an experience for personal transformation. And so I want to ask you, like, if you take a step back and look into the process of creating any kind of experience, whether it's an event or a retreat, what are some of the key considerations for the experienced designers to take note? Like, how can one intentionally approach creating an impactful and transformative experience?
I'm reading Dune right now, the book. I don't know why I thought of this, but I just read something like yesterday in there that there was a quote that beginnings are such delicate times. And I think for this kind of experience, that is so true. The first moments are the most important. I've heard this as well from a guy that runs a like private social club thing in Chiang Mai that I'm a member of. And he used to design hotels and still owns a couple of hotels, mostly in China. It's like an American dude, but he owns a bunch of property in China and operates these hotels. And he's obsessed with the first experience. He wants your experience coming into the space to be super impressive, because that's going to color everything else. And I noticed that with the rite of passage, the first few days are so important and so delicate, because people don't know what to expect. Right. Especially because I'm not giving them an itinerary. Like last year, they didn't have anything really to see except for cell phone pictures that I took of Thailand. They don't have like a reference point. They don't have testimonials and other people to talk to about how was it. So they just land and they had to figure it out day by day. And for me, it's this delicate balance, because I don't want to create the expectations. I don't want to tell you too much. I want you to kind of struggle a little bit, but I also want to make sure that people feel safe enough and comfortable enough to do a trip like this, because there's like a weird balance to be struck there. Because if you're too afraid of what the experience is, like if I told you, like, just pay me and sign up and show up here with a blindfold on, like if I make it too hardcore, then people just won't even approach it. But if I make it too easy, then they don't get a challenging experience out of. So I'm trying to thread the needle there and provide them an experience where they at least feel very comfortable getting here. And then once they're here, they know that I'm here, I'm leading, everything's going to be okay. Like if we get into a sticky situation, we'll figure out how to get out of it. And that will allow them then to be more comfortable and get more uncomfortable in other ways on the trip. So kind of operationalizing that, like I took a lot from, if you know who Alex Hormozi is, he's like a business guru, but he's legitimately a really good businessman. I read his book about creating an offer. How do you create a really compelling offer? And he really nails over and over again, you have to take care of every single one of their concerns. So while I have the itinerary up front, as I'm not giving you the itinerary, in the you'll see like on the sales page, I have so many FAQs on there because I want you to, if you leave that page without signing up, to really be sure that this is not the experience for you. I don't want you to leave and just, I don't know if it's right. I want you to have all your questions answered right there. And so for the experience before they arrive, I provide everything like way above and beyond what I'm sure any tour company is doing. I write a whole massive Google Doc of here's what you should pack and the weather you should expect and what to expect getting to Thailand. If you're going to Bangkok, here's recommendations of places to go, all of that. I'm very glad that I did that because it was worse than I thought, actually. Like people were very on edge and not really comfortable. You know, they're head on a swivel. Like, is this a dangerous area? And I'm like, there are no dangerous parts of Chiang Mai. You're totally fine. But I'm so relaxed. It was kind of like, why are you so relaxed? You know, we need to be on edge. Like I sent their suitcases back to my house in a Grab, in like an Uber, basically. And one guy was like, do you know this guy? Like, who is this guy? Why is he taking our stuff? And I'm like, it's like an Uber, man. I do this all the time. I've done this with expensive stuff. I'll put it in an Uber without me and send it somewhere else. Like, it'll be fine. I can track him on my phone. I have his name. I have everything on his Grab profile if anything really does happen. And of course, nothing happened, but I saw that sort of, it took a little time to melt away, but by the third, fourth day, people were very relaxed and very different from the first few days. Like much more relaxed than some people were commenting, more relaxed than they are at home.
That's such a great tip because it is because you're almost over preparing them and then show them that you're in it. You know, you're in it. You're providing all these support. You're not just some random guy on the internet trying to scam them and make money. Like you're really providing your care with a lot of thought and it shows before they arrive. And that's a great commitment for someone fly all the way from the States, let's say, to Thailand. It was a 12-hour time difference and get thrown into this world that they have nothing, they know nothing about, like language, culture, food, everything, right? So by providing that, go for the extra mile to provide that care, it actually allows them to be relaxed and be okay with not knowing things when they're there. And imagine if you don't tell them anything and then they arrive and then you still don't tell them anything. And that's when they're gonna freak out. Cause they don't, yeah. They cannot see the proof of work or they cannot see that you care. And these people trust their lives with you, with what you're taking them to do.
There's a concept in like tech and onboarding as well in product. I used to work in product marketing and that's actually where I probably got this focus on beginnings from, is there's this concept of like time to value or delivering value very early. And I always tried to do this with the products that I worked on, like create some value very quickly. And Alex Hormozi talks about this as well. Like as soon as people pay, before they see the receipt, they should get something valuable. They should feel like, okay, I got some return for it, because you leave a really bad taste in people's mouth if they pay you a bunch and they're like, what happened? You know, what am I getting for this? It's that very beginning. If you deliver them immediately, here's something that you can see, I put effort into this. And it's hard to do with a trip because they're paying for the trip, but the trip happens at a certain time. So that's why I try to do this with the onboarding materials. Like they have something to read and look at. I put them in a Telegram group with everyone else. So they feel like, okay, the experience has begun now, not necessarily when I land. And that kind of shows people that they got something for their money immediately. And it's sort of a Pavlovian dog thing. Like you're paying clicks. A lot of tech products do this literally with graphics and stuff. You buy something and they're like, yay, and open a box for you to make your brain shoot a little dopamine and associate paying them with a good feeling, you know. But it's important. I mean, it triggers the animal brain in important ways.
When people make the commitment to go through such a thing, their journey actually starts from the moment they decide to do it. I definitely feel like in this conversation, I've learned more about Thailand. I've learned more about your program. And I feel like this is actually, now I really want to go, because how you're structuring it, it's so unique. And I'm the type of, like, I'm a very spontaneous traveler, and I'm the type of person that will find out where I'm going to visit on the day while I'm eating breakfast. And I'll find out where's my next destination, and I'll tour around a bunch. And then when I'm tired, when I'm ready to move on, I'll find a bench to sit down and think, now what? So it's a very random process. And the thing with solo travel is that even if I can be spontaneous to that extent, I still need to figure out where I'm going to go. And I still need to figure out the logistics for myself. And that takes away some of the fun, to be honest, because I like not knowing. I like to be taken care of to a really well thought of trip without ever worrying about the logistics. So it sounds like a perfect type of trip for me, combined with the place that I've heard so many great things about Thailand and Chiang Mai over the years. I very much enjoyed the souvenir you gave me from Thailand. And maybe this is a sign for me to start planning to visit at some point, hopefully very soon. And I'm sure that I hope this conversation will serve as a sign for some people listening to this conversation when they are thinking about making a move, when they're feeling the itch in the back of their mind, or feeling that rock in their shoe that's so uncomfortable and yet they cannot identify the source. Maybe you just need a radical change. Move to Thailand or anywhere else, or Mexico City or Amsterdam, name it, to turn your life around and see what happens with an open-minded with an open heart and some personal responsibilities. And then maybe you will surprise yourself. What's the best way to keep close to your work?
Follow me on Twitter is probably the best way. I'm Captain Sid. I think it's going to be in my name, Captain, and then S-I-D-D. That's probably the best place where I post the most often. I'm on Nostrum, Instagram, and other places too, but you can probably find all those through my Twitter. The other place to follow Rite of Passage is the website, riteofpassage.live. And it's ride, not write. It's R-I-D-E. And if you go to riteofpassage.live/early-access and sign up there, that's the email list where when I announce new trips, I will post it there first. And basically the way that I'm going to do these trips going forward is, like, the email list will hear about it first. Then I'll tweet it out and I'll start doing outreach and whatnot and going on podcasts and everything. But like I said earlier, I don't really, like, maybe someday I will get to the point where I will have, you know, 20 trips every month or whatever, and this will be a bigger operation. But for now, it's very small. So I have very limited seats on these trips. So if you hear about it first, you have a better chance to get a good seat. And I'm going to start doing tiered pricing as well, like conferences do too. So if you're on the email list, you're going to get the best possible price. And then if you hear about me later from a podcast or whatever, you're going to pay a much higher price. So that's riteofpassage.live/early-access.
I'm sure your story radically changed your life, and becoming this less shy and more calm and present person, it's a direction a lot of people are looking to take in their lives, perhaps with or without Bitcoin. So the journey that you went through and the journey that you bring to other people, it's going to bring a lot of good karma into the world, because more people can hopefully stay true to themselves and understand who they really are and approach life, approach existential crisis in a more productive and less painful way. So thank you for the work you do, both for promoting the charm of Thailand, as well as uniting Bitcoiners in a beautiful place, uniting them through beautiful experiences. And I certainly look forward to one day partaking the program and see for myself. Maybe during my next existential crisis. You just missed this one, but there's always going to be existential crisis down the line. So thank you again for joining the show, Evan, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Live with Bitcoin. I'm your host, Vivian, and then we'll see you in the next one.